We don't quite have a quorum, but we can get started here. I'll call this meeting of Labor and Industry Policy and Finance Committee for today, Groundhog's Day, February 2nd, to order. On our agenda today is overview by the Department of Labor and Industry. Welcome to the committee. And if you want to introduce yourselves, and then you can proceed with your presentation. And I may have to, once we get a quorum, I may interrupt to do the minutes, or we can wait till the end.
Okay, great. Thank you, Chair Nelson and members of the committee. My name is Nicole Blissenbach, and I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you so much for having me here today to do the agency overview. It is like Groundhog's Day because I got to do this in the Senate already, and now I'm happy to be here in the Labor Committee. So thank you so much for having us. And with me is Josiah Moore, who is our legislative coordinator at the department, and he will be helping me out by running the PowerPoint slides. I'm going to try not to bore everyone. There's a lot of detail in here about the department. We do very exciting things, but it coming out of my mouth maybe doesn't make it as exciting as being able to witness it. So if you have questions as I'm going along, please feel free to jump in and ask me. I can do my best to answer, and if I don't know the answer, I also have a number of directors from within the and other assistant commissioners and the deputy commissioner here to help me out if there are questions that I may not know. So I just want to remind the committee, first of all, of what the mission of the Department of Labor and Industry is. And the mission is to ensure Minnesota's work and living environments are equitable, healthy, and safe. We have a number of operating areas within the department. Some are very well known and some are not well known at all. So I'll quickly go through high level what those are. We have our workers' compensation division, and as many people are familiar, workers' compensation division ensures appropriate benefits are delivered to injured workers efficiently and at a reasonable cost. This division strives to create an environment where injured workers promptly receive benefits and services and where the system operates efficiently and cost effectively. We also have the OSHA division within the department. Minnesota OSHA helps keep Minnesota workplaces safe and healthy through separate compliance, which are the workplace inspection and investigations, and then consultation, which is a free voluntary workplace safety and health service that is offered. We also have our labor standards unit, which protects workers and promotes compliance through education and enforcement of wage and hour laws, child labor, prevailing wage, and other employment laws. When you hear people talk about wage theft prevention and enforcement, that is what this unit does. We also have Apprenticeship Minnesota, which promotes and facilitates the development of quality registered apprenticeship programs that help employers recruit, train, and retain a highly skilled and diverse workforce in Minnesota. The program also conducts compliance to ensure the protection and advancement of apprentices that are training in their program. We have our Construction Codes and Licensing Division, which protects public health and safety through the enforcement of reasonable and uniform construction standards focused on improving efficiencies in the delivery, inspection, permitting, licensing, and other construction regulatory services to industry stakeholders. One of our smaller programs is our Dual Training Pipeline Program, supports employers in building their own dual training programs that strategically combine related instruction with on-the-job training to ensure skilled workforce. That program targets four high-demand industries: advanced manufacturing, agriculture, healthcare services, and information technology. And then our Youth Skills Training Program supports the development of partnership between education entities and employers to provide students 16 and older with classroom instruction, safety training, and paid work experience in high growth, high demand occupations. That part of the department does grants to these entities that are offering these programs. Then we have our combative sports area. So the Office of Combative Sports ensures Minnesota's combative sporting events are conducted in a manner that minimizes injuries and ensures fair competition. And then finally, our general support area, which performs support functions for the agency. So that includes our communications, financial services, human resources, Office of General Counsel, projects and planning, public engagement, and research and statistics. So the next slide is an org chart. So that's included in your packets. I'm not going to go through that in depth, but it kind of outlines the structure of the agency. So while this is an agency overview, and I'm sure I'll be back in the near future to present an overview of our budget items for this session, the next two slides are really focused on a quick overview of the agency budget to understand the different sources of funding to the agency. So as this chart shows, the largest, this shows the source of appropriations by fund. The Workers' Compensation Fund is the largest source of funding for the agency, and this is from an assessment on insurers and self-insurers that are active in Minnesota. The Construction Codes Fund is revenue from licenses, permits, inspections, and work performed by the agency. And as you can see by this pie chart, the general fund is a small fraction of our overall revenue funding to the agency. So labor and industry's base budget for fiscal year 24-25 is $217.35 million. And of that approximately $217 million, about $26 million is general fund. And that goes to fund labor standards, IT modernization. Again, as I mentioned, the majority of funding comes from the Workers' Compensation Fund and the Construction Code Funds. All right, so I'm going to jump into each of our business units and give a little bit more detail about what they do. So I'll start with the Workers' Compensation Division. And on the slide, you'll see, on the side, kind of a by the numbers approach, which talks, you know, which gives a highlight of some of the really important work that the division does. So they've conducted 740 mediations in the last year, 16.1 million benefits paid to injured workers in fiscal year 2022. Vocational rehabilitation clients returning to work had their wages restored to 93% of their pre-injury level. So these are all really great achievements, and we like to highlight some of that. So as I mentioned, the Work Comp Division helps employees who have been injured on the job to receive proper medical treatment and benefit payments in a timely manner. They also mediate disputes about injuries and benefits, issue penalties for late benefit payments to injured workers, and review records to ensure that state laws are followed. So the Workers' Compensation Division is made up of six different areas. We have the Alternative Dispute Resolution, and this unit seeks early intervention in work comp disputes through administrative conferences and mediations, and really just focuses on helping to resolve those disputes before having to go on to contested hearings. The Business Technology Office is responsible for managing business needs, policies, and priorities related to the use and ongoing support of key technology systems. And that includes the Work Comp campus system, which is the new IT system in the Work Comp for workers' compensation. Next, we have Compliance Records and Training, or CRT, and they maintain work comp claim files. So all the claims records and training ensures compliance with benefit provisions of the Work Comp law by auditing workers' compensation claims, penalizing insurers for late payment, and providing educational outreach. They also register qualified rehabilitation consultants, or QRCs, and provide analysis of medical and rehabilitation issues. We also house the Office of Workers' Compensation Ombudsman, and this is a separate entity within the Department of Labor and Industry, and its purpose is to inform and assist and empower injured workers and small businesses who are having difficulty navigating the system and to help resolve problems that are encountered through that system. The Special Compensation Fund administers workers' compensation claims of injured employees who work for employers that failed to have workers' compensation coverage or that may have declared bankruptcy. So the Special Compensation Fund also administers the uninsured, bankrupt, self-insured, and asbestos claims and claims related to the supplementary benefit and second injury reimbursement programs. Next, we have the Vocational Rehabilitation Unit, or the VOC Rehab Unit, and they provide VOC rehab services to help injured workers return to work. The special comp assessments paid by insurers and self-insurers fund all of the worker compensation programs at DLI, as well as the operating expenses of the Office of Administrative Hearings, Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals, and the anti-fraud activities at the Department of Commerce, or the Commerce Fraud Bureau. Right. Next, I have a slide on the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council. This is just one of the councils supported by DLI, and I wanted to highlight for the committee the important role that this council plays. The council recommends legislation pertaining to workers' compensation and advises the department in carrying out the purposes of Chapter 176. So there are six representatives, each from business and organized labor, and that makes up the council. The four legislative caucuses and the governor each appoint one labor and one business representative, and the heads of the state's largest labor group, the Minnesota AFL-CIO, and the state's largest business group, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, are permanent members. DLI provides administrative support, and I, as the commissioner, serve as the non-voting chair of the council. So by law, the Work Comp Advisory Council approval requires a near consensus of members, the support of a majority of both labor and business delegations. And due to decades of contention over work comp bills at the legislature in 1995, legislators informally agreed that all future work comp bills would need to be recommended by the Labor Business Work Comp Advisory Council before passage. The purpose of that informal agreement was really to place responsibility for resolving differences before the legislature acted in the hands of those most affected by statutory changes, the employers and workers. The Work Comp Advisory Council generally meets the second Wednesday of the month from 9:30 to 11:30, although that schedule is subject to change, and we've been meeting a little bit more frequently now that the legislative session is in session. All right, so moving on to Minnesota OSHA compliance. The OSHA compliance enforces the Minnesota Occupational Safety and Health Act and standards that assure safe and healthful working conditions for Minnesota workers. And they do that through a number of things, helping employers comply with safety and health regulations, conducting workplace inspections and investigations, and providing technical assistance, training, and outreach. And just to highlight some of the numbers, so in the last fiscal year, OSHA compliance conducted 1,367 compliance inspections, did outreach and training to over 3,600 participants, and handled over 7,000 phone and email inquiries. Next, turning to OSHA workplace safety consultation. Consultation provides a variety of free services to employers, including on-site consultation, training, education and outreach in general industry and in construction settings. The services that this unit provides are provided by safety and health experts who are qualified occupational safety and health professionals. And they're basically the consultation arm of Minnesota OSHA. So the services are free. There are no citations or fines issued when an employer is working with consultation, provided that the employer agrees to correct all hazards that are identified by the consultant who is out conducting the consultation. This unit also runs the Safety Grant Program, which is a program that assists employers in making their work sites safer for their employees. So it awards funds with a dollar-to-dollar match up to $10,000 for projects designed to reduce the risk of injury or illness for workers. All right, moving on to construction codes and licensing, or we love our acronyms in state government. So this is our CCLD division. This division develops and enforces construction-related health and safety codes for the construction of buildings. The division also licenses boiler operators, electricians, electrical and technology system contractors, elevator constructors, high-pressure piping pipe fitters, manufactured home installers, plumbers, plumbing contractors, power limited technicians, residential building contractors, remodelers, and roofers. The division also certifies building officials. So it really works to protect the public in a number of ways, through education, through inspection, plan review, licensing, enforcement, and then also the Contractor Recovery Fund, which helps make homeowners whole when they are defrauded by licensed building contractors. So very important piece of their work. And actually, the by the numbers, I would like to draw some attention to that, because when I was looking at it, I'm like, wow, these numbers seem off. But they are accurate. 192,669 inspections were conducted in 2020. So just to emphasize the large impact they have and the important work they do. All right. Yes.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Commissioner, for that. That's interesting that that's a 2020 statistic. Was 2020, did 2020 and the pandemic impact the number of inspections and work that your office was able to do? And how did, I mean, this seems like a very, I think this is an impressive high number. And it strikes me that it's odd, like, that this much work was conducted in 2020, which was a turbulent year where we've seen in other places. So I'm wondering how the pandemic impacted that, and if that is typical, if there's a reason why, if that's typical or not, and if it's not, maybe why, if that makes sense.
Commissioner.
Chair Nelson and Representative Jordan, that's a great question, because it allows me to highlight some of the important work we've been doing around virtual inspections, mm-hmm. Which has, I think it, the pandemic allowed us to get creative and to look at our work and determine which things we needed to do the traditional way that we've always done and which things we could tackle in a different way. And I can ask Director McClellan to come up, but I know that that really was an impetus for us to start doing more virtual inspections, and that has been a priority now for the department. So would you like to know a little bit more about that?
Maybe we can.
Maybe we can at the end, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
I got another question from Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is going back a couple of slides, because I didn't know if we were saving questions till the end. It's a question around your youth skills training, or maybe it was also the dual training pipeline. You mentioned that 16-year-olds can take a classroom course and then maybe have some on-the-job opportunities. Does that include being on job sites as a 16-year-old youth?
Commissioner, I think she means construction job sites.
Yes.
Commissioner.
Okay, Chair Nelson and Representative Berg, thank you for the question. So the youth skills training program that we run at the department only targets certain industries, and construction is not one of the industries that is covered in that program.
Thank you, Representative Berg.
Thank you. I appreciate that, because we spend some time here in the legislature trying to make sure our kiddos are safe while they are having some opportunities to look at different pathways for their future. So I appreciate that that's not one of the places that they're spending time. Thank you.
Commissioner.
Go ahead. All right. Continue. Thank you, Chair Nelson, members of the committee. Next, I'll highlight Office of Combative Sports, which I think is one of the areas that people are usually surprised that the Department of Labor and Industry has under its umbrella. But essentially, our role is that of safety and health, once again. So it ensures that Minnesota's combative sporting events are conducted in a manner that minimizes injuries and ensures fair competition. So we regulate professional boxing and professional mixed martial arts. And so we license combatants, coroners, officials, promoters, and ringside physicians. In 2022, we had 16 events, and you can see some of the other numbers, but we have 405 licensed coroners, 67 licensed officials, and 11 licensed promoters. But really, it's a small but mighty unit within DLI. They do incredible work, and I was able to see them at in practice one time, and it's just impressive the amount of detail that they have as they're going out to make sure those events are run safely and fairly.
And Commissioner, that's coroners, not, my hearing is, many years working construction, but it's not coroners, it's coroners.
Coroner, yes. Yeah. Chair Nelson, yes, the corner of a, as you would think of as a boxing ring.
Representative Wolgamott, you had a question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation, Commissioner. I was just wondering, I had two questions about the Office of Combative Sports. How long have we had this office in the state of Minnesota? And does such an office exist in other states, or are we unique in having this Office of Combative Sports?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Nelson and Representative Wolgamott. So I actually don't know the answer of when it was moved to the department. I may have to phone a friend for that, but I believe it used to be a separate boxing commission, and it was brought under the umbrella of labor and industry. And I think different states do it differently. So some states may have a separate boxing commission that is probably regulated by the state, but not within their departments of labor. But I can provide, if you would like me to call someone up, I could. Otherwise, I can follow up with you on that as well.
Follow up is sufficient. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. Representative Koslowski, you had a question.
Thank you, Chair Nelson and Commissioner. I'm curious, what power does the office have in you as a commissioner to change the outcome of MMA fighting matches?
Commissioner.
Yes, Chair Nelson and Representative. So after a contest is done, people can file with the department if they have a challenge. So if they're challenging a ruling that an official made, that can be filed with the department, and it goes through the process that many administrative challenges go through, where we would issue a final decision after it goes goes through an Office of Administrative Hearings process.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you for that.
Why don't you continue then, Commissioner?
Thank you, Chair Nelson. So moving on to our labor standards unit. So the labor standards unit, as I mentioned earlier, is really what, when people talk about wage theft enforcement, this is the unit that does that. They enforce a number of statutes that are under the department's jurisdiction, including child labor statutes, minimum wage, overtime, prevailing wage, the Women's Economic Security Act, which includes laws related to pregnancy accommodation, pregnancy and parenting leave, sick and safe leave, nursing mothers, and wage disclosure. They also handle independent contractor misclassification in the construction industry. Looking at the last year, they've served over and impacted more than 200,000 workers, recovered in the last 5 years, recovered more than $6.75 million in wages, and responded to over 20,000 inquiries related to wage and hour laws. So this unit does incredible work, but we know we're just scratching the surface of wage theft, which is why this unit has really refocused their model from being primarily complaint-based to being more strategic enforcement driven. So looking at industries where we know wage theft has a big impact and is happening often, where we can make the biggest difference, and really looking at the most egregious behavior by employers and trying to target that, as well as the industries where we know workers are less likely to complain because of the situation they're in. So really trying to move towards that model than just relying on complaint-driven enforcement.
Commissioner, Representative Berg had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Just a quick question on the wage theft. I'm wondering how you gather the information so that you know where to go to rectify, and whether or not you have like a sustainable part of the department that does that work.
Commissioner.
Chair Nelson, Representative Berg. So It's a number of sources that we use to determine what industries we're seeing the most egregious conduct. So we have community partners, whether that be community organizations, different worker advocates that work with workers that may not have traditional avenues to the department, unions and other partners that we have in the community. Really give us information about what's happening on the ground out in the field. And we use that information to then think about, you know, where can we have the biggest effect? We can't be everywhere all the time. We don't have the resources to do that, unfortunately. But we know that if we target our investigations and our enforcement in a way that people take notice, that will have a bigger effect and we can be bigger than we are. We also work very closely with our partners at the federal level, at the U.S. Department of Labor in the Wage and Hour Division, as well as the Attorney General's Office, who has a wage theft unit. And then some cities have minimum wage ordinances, prevailing wage ordinances. We always like to keep those lines of communications open so that we're not repeating each other's work, that we're really having a bigger effect by not all doing the same thing all the time.
Representative Burr.
Thank you. That was a great answer.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Blissenbach. Question about independent contractor misclassification and whether, because we know that that's an issue everywhere, and sort of the restrictions or the statutory reasons that it's just in the construction industry that Dolly has that authority?
Commissioner.
Chair Nelson, Representative Greenman, thank you for that question because I think it is an area that there is a lot of misunderstanding around. So misclassification can happen in every industry where you have an employer that would traditionally be an employer of an employee, and instead of treating that employee as an employee, they classify them as an independent contractor, which means they're likely not paying employment taxes, unemployment insurance, overtime. And not providing the protection, workers' compensation insurance, sorry, that was the thing I was blanking on, which is one of the largest parts of the department, of course. So what all of those things are harms. You know, it's harming the state, it's harming the worker, and it's harming the industry. And we can enforce our laws that are affected. So if you have an employer who's not carrying workers' compensation insurance to cover employees, we can enforce that. If they're not paying overtime and it is in fact a worker or an employee instead of an independent contractor, we can enforce overtime. The thing that's different about misclassification in the construction industry versus other industries is that there is a law that is violated in and of itself just by having misclassification. So instead of misclassification being the way you violate a bunch of other laws, in construction it's also a violation in and of itself. And that's really the difference. So the misclassification portion of the labor standards unit enforces the misclassification in construction laws, which is in Chapter 326B.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Commissioner Blissenbach. That was really helpful. Thank you.
Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. A question I had did revolve around complaints, and I'm just wondering, you know, what percentage of complaints turn into investigations and then from there either turn into fines or enforcement?
Commissioner.
If you know that.
Chair Nelson and Representative Myers, I am not sure about the percentage. I'm sure that we could pull those numbers. We get a lot of calls in our labor standards unit, and we do. We have a really good process to try to resolve some of the one-offs really quickly. So, if it's a last paycheck issue, and somebody calls in and they say, you know, I just quit, and my employer isn't sending me my last paycheck, we're going to just contact the employer and say, this is your obligation. You need to pay at least every 31 days. You need to provide them with their money. Almost 100% of the time, the employer's like, okay, we're going to provide the money. Usually they're like, you know, there's a reason they haven't done it. Well, they took something they shouldn't have, and we have to explain, well, it's still your obligation to pay wages that are owed, and if there's something else, you can proceed in a different manner to recover that. So I would say that the majority of calls that do come into the department, we're able to resolve very quickly, informally. The employee's happy, the employer complies with their obligations, and we don't have to open an investigation. Typically, when we're opening an investigation, it's when it's systemic or when it's more egregious. It's a larger amount of money. It's affecting more workers. But I don't know the percentage of those informally resolved versus the ones that turn into investigations. So I apologize for that.
Representative Myers.
That's okay. Thank you for that. I mean, would you be able to give a range? I mean, we're not going to hold it to you, I guess.
I don't even know if I could take a guess. I'm sorry.
No, and that's okay. And, it leads me to my follow-up. I am a new member. You know, we'd had some very heartfelt testimony that we saw here on a warehouse workers bill, which left me really frustrated because, you know, this is a bill that's come before in years past. And, you know, testifiers came up. Appreciate them sharing their stories to us, but it seemed to be a consistent long term over a year that this was happening. And Min OSHA Representative Kruger, I think it was, mm-hmm. was here, was very unfamiliar with if there was even an investigation. And so what I hate to see is if, you know, employees are being treated like that for such a long time that there hasn't been some sort of investigation or response. I'm just hoping to better understand what's being done in that situation. You know, there is a bill that came out of this committee, but I'm wondering if there's something that can be done sooner than later. And, you know, we're already looking at past a year on this.
Commissioner.
Chair Nelson, Representative Myers, thank you for that question. I am familiar with the bill you're speaking of. And I think that maybe the disconnect there is that bill is actually addressing something that is not currently addressed in OSHA standards or in the laws that exist in Minnesota. So the requirement, what that bill does is it requires the employer to give notice of certain expectations that are had for workers, or what the bill describes as quotas. And that's not currently required under OSHA standards. So if OSHA were going into a work site or into one of the warehouses covered by that bill and didn't find any notice provided to the employees of the expectations or of these quotas, they wouldn't be able to do anything. And then also ergonomics are not directly addressed by OSHA standards either. And so a lot of the injuries we're seeing come out of places like warehouses, meat processing facilities, are the repetitive stress injuries, and they're not directly addressed by OSHA standards currently. There was an attempt to do so at the federal level, and it was overturned by Congress. So I do appreciate that. It's actually something that I'm looking at more closely because it is something that does need to be addressed. So I agree with you.
Representative Myers.
Yeah, and thank you for that. You know, I was just really frustrated to hear that this was going on. And from the testifiers, it sounded like it was a workplace safety issue. I have to think, I mean, from listening to their testimony, there was safety concerns going on. So to hear that there wasn't a way to address it, I guess I'm really surprised from the testimony I heard. So.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Nelson. All right, moving on. Apprenticeship Minnesota. So in the states, the DLI is the state's apprenticeship authority under the Minnesota Apprenticeship Act, and we're recognized by the U.S. Department of Labor and their Office of Apprenticeship. So this division promotes and facilitates the development of quality registered apprenticeship programs. These programs help employers recruit, train, and retain a highly skilled and diverse workforce in Minnesota. The unit and the staff in that unit conduct compliance reviews to ensure that both the protection and advancement of apprenticeships training in the different programs. And they work to ensure opportunities through apprenticeship for underrepresented Minnesotans, including women, people of color, indigenous people, veterans, and people with disabilities. Right. Youth skills training, and I think we kind of hit on this in the overview. We hit on all of this in the overview, but a little bit more detail. Supports the development of partnerships. So these are partnerships that, like, for instance, a school district may enter into with an employer. to provide opportunities for 16 and 17-year-olds with both the classroom instruction, which always includes a safety component, and then paid work experience in high-growth, high-demand occupations. Grant money is available for these partnerships to create and implement the Youth Skills Training Program. They work closely with our OSHA consultation unit to ensure that the placements that we're putting the students into are safe and that they're not operating hazardous machinery, and where they are, that it's supervised to make the experience as safe as possible for the students that are there. All right. Dual training pipeline supports employers in building their own dual training programs, which by strategically combining related instruction with on-the-job training to develop that skilled workforce. This is a program that I think we're getting more and more attention for in the industries that we cover, because employers are realizing, I can't just go find the person who knows how to do the job anymore. I need to invest in the talent and bring it up from within. And this is one of the ways that employers can make that investment. So the targets, again, are four different high-growth industry sectors: advanced manufacturing, agriculture, healthcare services, and information technology. And they do bring together leaders from those industries to identify, define, create, and validate those competencies for the in-demand careers. All right, I think that brings us to the end of all of the different areas of the department, and I'm happy to answer any other questions if there are any.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Commissioner Blissenbach, I have a quick question. I think this is slide 7, if I'm counting right, on the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council. And my question is around some of the language used there.
Representative Hill, can you bring the mic down?
I can.
So that we can.
There you go. Hopefully Thank that's you. A little better. What I wanted to learn more about, it says in the third bullet point there that by law, the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council requires a near consensus of members. And I'm familiar with the concept of consensus, but near consensus is new to me. And so if you could share a little bit more about that, bring some clarity, please. Thank you.
Commissioner.
Chair Nelson, Representative Hill. So what the law requires is for the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council to have passed, so they recommend legislation. In order for it to be council approved, there needs to be a support from the majority of both the labor and the business delegation for it to come out with council approval.
Representative Hill.
Chair Nelson, thank you. Commissioner, appreciate that.
And if I remember right, Representative Hill and Commissioner, that was done. The reason why they did that in 95 is there had been a couple years where workers' comp laws went back and forth depending who was the majority, and this was a way to try and settle that down to give some predictability with the workforce and with management, instead of having every year the laws change radically one way or the other. Commissioner, any other questions? If not, thank you for the presentation and for the overview, and hope to see you here on other bills that we have come forward.
I'm sure we will. Thank you so much.
Representative Mecklen, did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
I did, and I so moved.
Representative Mecklen moves the minutes from meeting of January 31st. All those in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes have been approved. Members, have some bills next week, hopefully. They're coming to us slow, and they're coming to us. People are still working on some of the bills that have come to us already. So we'll be starting to hear some bills and hopefully putting together an omnibus bill later on in session. So
okay.
Any questions or concerns? If not, members, we are adjourned.